Today is Thursday, February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. Coming up,
the UN estimates landmines and explosive remnants of war have killed and maimed some 30,000 civilians, with young children accounting for the largest number of victims.
Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump says there is no basis for a powerful legislative committee to investigate his personal finances, and the EU says it is not open to changes to Britain's withdrawal from the EU, known as Brexit. It all is on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says there is no basis for a powerful legislative committee to investigate his personal finances. VOA's White House Chief Bureau Chief Steve Miller has details.
House Intel Trump, Steve Herman, White House Correspondent Report. Intro. U.S. President Donald Trump says there is no basis for a powerful legislative committee to investigate his personal finances. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has details. Text in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Asked about the House Intelligence Committee's decision to examine his finances, Trump is calling it presidential harassment, and he is blaming the committee's chairman, Adam Schiff, a California Democrat.
On what basis would he do that? He has no basis to do that. He's just a political hack who's trying to build a name for himself.
Hours earlier, Schiff had declared his committee would broaden its investigation to go beyond Russia and examine whether Trump's concern for his financial interests, whether in Russia, Saudi Arabia, or elsewhere, are driving his policy decisions and other actions as president. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
On what basis would he do that? He has no basis to do that.
European Union Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker today told British Prime Minister Theresa May that the EU is not open to renegotiating Britain's withdrawal from the EU. The two met in Brussels in an effort to reach a deal acceptable to both Britain and the rest of the EU. European Commission spokesman Margarita Skinas gave reporters the statement from Juncker and May.
President Juncker underlined that the EU27 will not reopen the withdrawal agreement, which represents a carefully balanced compromise between the European Union and the United Kingdom, in which both sides have made significant concessions to arrive at a deal.
The spokesman added that talks on other issues will continue.
President Juncker, however, expressed his openness to add working to the political declaration agreed by the EU27 and the UK in order to be more ambitious in terms of content and speed when it comes to the future relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom.
May is seeking changes to Britain's agreement with the EU, which Parliament rejected last month. Talks will continue. The top EU negotiator will meet with the new negotiator for Britain on Monday. May and Junckers will meet again late this month. U.S. President Donald Trump says he expects to declare victory over the Islamic State extremist group's self-declared caliphate in the next week. He made the statement yesterday at a gathering in Washington of officials from the global coalition that battled IS in Syria and Iraq.
Thanks to the global coalition, including all of you here today, and to our other partners, the ISIS caliphate has been decimated.
Foreign ministers and officials from the 79-member coalition met to develop plans for security forces in Syria. Trump last year announced the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the area, but troops remain because of concerns about the return of the group. Yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called on coalition partners to continue their efforts against the group.
The fight is one that we will continue to wage alongside of you. The drawdown of troops is essentially a tactical change. It is not a change in the mission.
Top U.S. military and intelligence officials have told Congress the Islamic State could present a lasting threat to Syria if pressure is not maintained against it. Among the top stories in the world, Venezuelan soldiers block a key border crossing from Colombia that is preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid from the United States and other foreign nations. While Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accuses the U.S. of imperialism in its efforts to oust Venezuelan President Maduro. Taliban and influential Afghan opposition leaders say that a complete withdrawal from U.S.-led foreign forces is key to a lasting peace in Afghanistan. And Hong Kong takes the first steps in criminalizing disrespect for China's national anthem in what critics say is a bid to stem political criticism in the semi-autonomous city. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website and on your VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. UND miners in Afghanistan say the number of people being killed and maimed by landmines in Afghanistan is rising due to newly laid landmines by the Taliban in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations has been involved in clearing landmines in Afghanistan for 29 years. Over that period, the UN and partners have cleared some 730,000 anti-personnel and anti-tank mines at a cost of $1.5 billion. The UN estimates landmines and explosive remnants of war have killed and maimed some 30,000 civilians, with young children accounting for the largest number of victims. While casualties have been steadily going down, the UN says there's been an increase in numbers in recent years. Patrick Fruchet is program manager of UNMAS, the UN Mine Action Service in Afghanistan. In 2012, he says there was an average of 36 casualties a month. He says that number increased to more than 150 casualties a month in 2017. He tells VOA that is due to new contamination by Taliban forces.
The United Nations established, as of about 2010, that the Taliban movement was manufacturing improvised landmines inside Afghanistan and deploying them inside Afghanistan. That has been denied by the Taliban movement, but we stand by the statement.
British photographer Giles Dooley lost both legs and an arm when he stepped on a landmine in Afghanistan in 2011. As CEO and founder of the Legacy of War Foundation, he works on behalf of landmine survivors around the world. He says he has seen a lot of money being spent on demining activities and millions spent on medical care.
But what I've seen is this huge gap in what happens to the survivors of landmines after that. The sort of the motto that I've always used is there's no point saving a life if you don't give somebody their life back.
Dooley says people who have been disabled through no fault of their own should be given the opportunity to regain their dignity. He says they should be taught skills so they can support themselves and their families. He says victims of war should be given the assistance and support needed to rebuild their lives and become productive members of society. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. An ongoing partnership to provide new health posts in rural Rwanda is making access to health care a reality for many families. S.C. Johnson and the Rwanda Ministry of Health announced plans to support the development of an additional 40 health posts throughout Rwanda, expanding access to health care and malaria education for more than 200,000 people. In 2018, S.C. Johnson established 10 healthcare posts in Rwanda, The goal of the partnership is to help address public health issues, including malaria, HIV/AIDS, family planning, and access to clean water and nutrition. Stephen Hogan is Senior Director of Global Public Affairs and Communication for SC Johnson. He spoke with my colleague, Kim Lewis, about the significance of the new initiative.
Malaria is one issue that is important to us. It's obviously, you know, one of the biggest killers in the world. And because of our pest control expertise, we're one of the largest manufacturers of pest control products in the world. And through our Center for Insect Science and Family Health, I think we're uniquely positioned to bring our expertise to bear against mosquito-borne disease. The program we have in Rwanda is part of that much larger effort that we have to combat malaria and mosquito-borne disease. We work in many parts of the world. In particular, Rwanda has been a great partner of ours. We've been working with them for more than 4 years. They have a very progressive, stable government. They've been fantastic to work with. And I think the health posts that we're supporting there are uniquely suited to helping to provide the tools and education needed to combat malaria.
Why are these health posts, what makes them unique?
The thing that makes them unique and the thing that you don't see in many parts of the world is they're very small posts. Kind of they're the first line of defense for combating disease in Rwanda. And they're really designed to be within about a 25-minute walk for most people versus, you know, a 3-hour walk for the larger health centers or hospitals. I think it's particularly important for women who are pregnant and have no other form of transportation. You know, the difference between a 25-minute walk and a 3-hour walk is probably the difference between, you know, 100 miles. It allows us to provide the tools and education, as I said, to really help combat mosquito-borne disease in a way that other health centers cannot.
Who runs these health posts and what type of training is required to do this?
Typically, they have a doctor or a nurse staff these health posts, but, you know, they're usually staffed by a handful of health workers. You know, the doctor or nurse would be the most highly trained. They've got a little pharmacy. They've got a treatment room. They've got kind of a triage room in the health post. You know, I know the goal of the Rwandan government is to have enough of these so that everybody in the country can be at one within a 25-minute walk.
Now, these health posts, they have really been very successful. So what would be your next step looking ahead?
We view Rwanda very much as a pilot for learning how to best combat malaria in a system like this, learning that we can take elsewhere in the world. One of the really important things that we have been doing is working with the Gates Foundation to get World Health Organization approval to put spatial repellents through the public health channel as an important tool to combat malaria, much the same way that bed nets today are used in the public health channel to combat malaria. It really takes an arsenal of tools, education to be effective, and we think spatial repellents can be an incredibly effective tool, and we're working to get that World Health Organization approval. Using the learning from Rwanda, we can take this effort and learning across many more countries.
That was Stephen Hogan, Senior Director of Global Public Affairs and Communication for SC Johnson. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Racine, Wisconsin. This is VOA's International Edition. Istanbul's governor said another person has been found dead in the rubble of a collapsed apartment building, raising the death toll to 3. Governor Ali Yerlakaya also said 12 people, including a 5-year-old girl, were rescued overnight. Rescuers quickly moved the injured to ambulances in Istanbul's Kartal district on the Asian side of the city today. Some residents reportedly said they heard an explosion before yesterday's collapse. The building is believed to be home to just over 40 people. It is unclear how many are still missing. The chief prosecutor's office is investigating the cause. And this is VOA's International Edition.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I just call to say I love you.
First, over 30 minutes of the continent's best pan-African music, commercial-free. Second, Song of the Week, Janjo by Daju. And then 2 exclusive interviews with artist Soul Prayer from Harare, Zimbabwe, and Free Boy from Kano, Nigeria.
Anywhere I go, I am the number one.
It's your boy, Free Boy Sunny, DJ Blando on the beat, Duma Records.
So lots of music love coming your way. Don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, this Sunday, 5 minutes past the hours of 15 and 2000 UTC.
The World Meteorological Organization says 2018 was the 4th hottest year on record, confirming what it calls a clear sign that long-term climate change is going on. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WMO headquarters in Geneva.
Of the 4 past record-breaking years, 2016 was the hottest. The World Meteorological Organization says temperatures that year reached a global average of 1.2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. It says the increased warming in the atmosphere was influenced by a strong El Niño event, which causes sea temperatures to rise in the tropical Pacific. Temperatures in 2018 dipped to 1 degree Celsius, but meteorologists say the ranking of individual years is less important than the long-term temperature trend engaging climate change. The WMO says other factors besides temperature are involved in changing climate. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says extreme weather events also play an important role.
Obviously, as we continue in 2019, we are seeing more extreme weather in different parts of the world, including dangerous and extreme cold in North America, record heat and wildfires in Australia, high temperatures and rainfall in parts of South America.
While Australia was baking in its warmest January on record, a cold weather front was gripping parts of the eastern United States. Nullis says freezing temperatures do not disprove climate change is happening.
We don't just have climate change. We have, you know, the daily weather. It's summer in the southern hemisphere right now. So we do expect to see high temperatures. It's winter in the northern hemisphere. We expect to see cold temperatures. But in the southern hemisphere, we have seen extreme heat. You know, a lot of records broken.
Nullis says every single heat wave cannot be attributed to climate change, but she notes extreme heat is one symptom of climate change. It is one of the phenomena expected from a changing climate. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA. In Southern California, there are some special creatures that have adapted and thrived in an urban environment. Some advocates for conservation and the environment say a city may be the perfect man-made space for some endangered species. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
What do these parrots and turtles have in common? Many of them are descendants of pets who immigrated to this urban jungle. Southern California is not their native homeland.
That is their outdoor voice, by the way. They are not quiet birds, so...
Ursula Heise is a professor at the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability and a bird lover. She's rescued and adopted some of these birds.
They come originally from northeastern Mexico, from the state of Tamaulipas, where they are now in danger.
As transplants to Southern California, these red-crowned parrots have thrived in the wild. They have become such a permanent fixture here that they are recognized by the California Bird Records Committee.
They've been naturalized as California citizens.
Similarly, these red-eared slider turtles, originally from the central United States, have adapted and thrived. They are now found across America and around the world. The success of these turtles and parrots in the Los Angeles area have some academics wondering whether a city can be a place to help endangered non-native animals, like a zoo, but better, say experts.
At least it's living in the wild. It's making its own living. It's having the lifestyle that that turtle or that parrot should have. It's just doing it in a different place.
We have put up major buildings. We've put expanses of concrete. We've introduced a completely different vegetation. And in many cases, that's led to a reduction of biodiversity because a lot of our created habitat is not hospitable to the native species. But the other side of that is that we've created new ecological niches and new kinds of habitats.
Conservation professor Brad Schaefer says non-native species would have to be carefully selected to ensure it does not harm the existing wildlife population in the city and beyond.
There's always that danger. And I think the real question is, can we minimize that danger by doing sort of the best possible ecological science to be able to identify species that will thrive in cities and won't thrive outside of cities?
Schaefer says species will migrate outside their native environment, potentially causing harm. He believes it might be better to carefully select a species to introduce as long as it's not harming biodiversity in a city. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Australia's Sydney Taronga Zoo is publicly celebrating the arrival of three newborn rare Sumatran tiger cubs. The zoo announced yesterday Sumatran tiger Kartika became a mother for the first time in mid-January, giving birth to two females and one male cub. The zoo says the births represent incredible success for the rare species, with only 350 remaining on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. So far, no names were given for the cubs, who are expected to go on display in March. You have been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Charleston Mock. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr., in Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA or on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.